It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, May 2nd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, former Senator of Wisconsin, Russ Feingold, on Citizens United, where we go from here. Also on the program, Alexis Goldstein. She is a member of Occupy SEC. On her experiences yesterday, massive protest in New York. It was, I think, as big as it's ever been, folks, in New York City for May Day. Across the country, San Francisco, Oakland, protests, some violence there. Occupy Chicago active. And of course, it's May Day, and across the world, tens of thousands of protesters protesting their government's lack of accountability and their failure in providing for workers' rights across the globe. Also on today's program, President Obama in Afghanistan to tout an agreement which basically calls for a future agreement and then perhaps an agreement after that. Also on the program today, some very wealthy Americans decide, screw America if I've got to pay taxes. Mitt Romney, at a time where foreign policy has come to the forefront in the presidential campaign, fires his chief foreign policy advisor because it turns out the guy is gay and maybe, according to conservatives, really gay. And finally, it couldn't happen to a better guy. Rupert Murdoch completely lambasted in a report by the British committee that's been investigating the phone hacking scandal in Britain. All this more. We have got a lot of news today. The interview with Senator Feingold is pre-taped. I pre-taped it the other day. It's not the longest interview, just I had about 12 minutes with him, but, you know, busy man. I got to say, I don't know if there is a podcast in existence that has ever interviewed Senator Feingold. I'm not touting my own horn, but I'm touting my own horn. And yes, folks, you get that for free. Now, we will be discussing much of the happenings that took place yesterday. We tried to give you a brief notion of what the feeling was like in Bryant Park from about 12 o'clock to 1:30 yesterday. That was just the beginning. the numbers just swelled and swelled and swelled. We'll talk to Matt about it. We'll talk to Alexis about it later in the program, because it was really quite something. Not to mention what was also quite something is I was on Young Turks last night. They were talking about Occupy. I came home to watch some MSNBC. When I was in the green room in the satellite area, I was watching Al Sharpton's show. I don't watch it that much. I don't watch much cable television. I watched a 10-minute interview with Meghan McCain, who I guess is a MSNBC contributor. A 10-minute interview about her experience in the tweets that she got responding to a photograph she tweeted with her and Sandra Fluck. Now, I guess that's interesting to some people, and fine. But I didn't see, and someone told me maybe it was on Ed. I didn't see it. I didn't watch Ed last night. But I didn't see on MSNBC primetime any mention of Occupy, which is bizarre because Fox ran with it. And yes, they did it to slam it. But the whole idea was, is Occupy back? There was a serious news question here. Would the Occupy movement be able to garner the same enthusiasm it had back in October, September, November of last year? Regardless of what the answer was, the question seemed relevant in terms of news. That question was not even addressed. I found that stunning. I really did. Before we go to the interview with Senator Feingold, which hopefully we'll be able to play. Matt, you'll give me the thumbs up. I don't know if you're aware of this, but yesterday wasn't simply May 1st. It wasn't simply May Day. It wasn't simply the anniversary of the killing of Osama bin Laden. God forgive me for actually saying those words, having those words come out of my mouth, because it seems sort of shocking that, we would mark that day. And yesterday wasn't just the resurgence of Occupy Wall Street. Yesterday, ladies and gentlemen, was also Loyalty Day. Oh, that wasn't what I wanted. Yesterday was Loyalty Day. A proclamation by the President of the United States more than two centuries ago, our founders laid out a charter that assured the rule of law and the rights of man. Now, I know many of you are anticipating the next sentence to be, so please disregard our policy on drones, on detaining personnel, on capturing whistleblowers, etc. Yeah, no, that wasn't what it was. And then it goes on with some flowery language. In order to recognize the American spirit of loyalty and the sacrifices that so many have made for our nation, the Congress, by Public Law 85-529, as amended, has designated May 1st of each year as Loyalty Day. On this day, let us reaffirm our allegiance to the United States of America, our Constitution, and our founding values. Now, therefore, I, Barack Obama, President of the United States of America, do hereby proclaim May 1, 2012 as Loyalty Day. This Loyalty Day, I call upon all the people of the United States to join in support of this national observance, whether by displaying the flag of the United States or pledging allegiance to the Republic for which it stands. Now, before you, I'm going to give you guys a moment to wipe the vomit off the bottom of your chin and regain your composure. Know that Loyalty Day was not, as that proclamation suggested, developed or first observed by President Obama. It was first observed in 1921 as Americanization Day. and it was intended to counterbalance the celebration of Labor Day on May 1st, which you all know is a holiday celebrated to commemorate the Haymarket Massacre in Chicago in 1886. In 1958, the U.S. Congress made an official holiday, and Dwight D. Eisenhower first proclaimed it on May 1st, 1959. All presidents since then, except I think Nixon and LBJ, have reiterated this proclamation, although it appears that President Obama was the first to do it twice. So, all right, folks, we're going to take a break. I will play the outro music, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Senator Russ Feingold. This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Folks, you can get, as a Majority Report listener, a free audio book. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. You know what you can pick up? That Daily Show book with Jon Stewart, where, you know, presents America, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. That's a perfect free audio book to get. You can get it at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. All right, folks, we are back, and here is that interview with Senator Russ Feingold from Monday morning. I'd like to welcome to the program former Senator of Wisconsin, author of the book While America Sleeps, and the founder of Progressives United, Senator Russ Feingold. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet, Sam. It's a pleasure.
So, you know, I've heard you speak about Citizens United many times, and I know that in 06 and 08, in the wake of McCain-Feingold campaign finance, you felt that campaign finance was at the very least on the right track. What did Citizens United do to campaign finance?
Well, it was an absolute body blow to the system after we were getting things going in a very different direction. I know it's hard for people to imagine that things were actually better and our memories are short, but in 2006 and 2008, we did not have the unlimited contributions to the political parties, the so-called soft money that had been so corrupting in the 1990s, and we got rid of that with McCain-Feingold. We did have 527s running around doing some stuff, but what they did was later declared to be illegal. So, you know, people in large part turned to democracy, to electronic democracy, the internet. And we had this advent of tremendous numbers of smaller contributions that led to other kinds of activism. And we really had the outlines of a very different and better system. There were more that had to be done, public financing and so on. But it really was improving. And the Supreme Court just threw a wrench into the whole thing with this almost lawless decision.
One of the things that struck me in the ruling on Citizens United, particularly, I think Justice Kennedy said, almost as a matter of law, the idea that that contributions do not corrupt campaigns. Tell me your thoughts on that.
Well, I don't know where he got that. He had no record whatsoever. I mean, this is a guy who's usually a careful justice. Unlike McCain-Feingold, where he had an extensive record that the court relied on very carefully, there was no record in this case at all. In fact, the case wasn't about this. And yet he just started making these sweeping assertions about what corruption was, what companies do, you know, like he was talking at a bar with somebody over a beer rather than anything that was a legal decision. So it was really reckless, and I'm guessing he might even be a little embarrassed at this point about what a sloppy opinion it was and how it just asserted things that aren't proven. You know, the Supreme Court in Buckley v. Valeo specifically talked about the role of corruption and the appearance of corruption play in our society. And I think almost everybody feels that these unlimited, undisclosed contributions have a tremendous potential for corruption.
I've heard you say that this system is less, it's more appropriate to refer to it as extortion than bribery. Explain what you meant by that.
Yeah, this is a correction that some business people made for me. When I was working on McCain-Feingold, I coined the term legalized bribery for the system. And we got a lot of support after a while from a bunch of CEOs who were sick and tired of being hit up. And they said, Russ, you know, you talk about legalized bribery. It's really legalized extortion. And I realized they were right. It's not like corporate CEOs sit around their office and go, you know, I'd like to throw some money around in the political process. I'd like to get rid of some of our money. It works the other way. The politicians call up and ask for the money. Especially with the soft money system. You know, somebody calls up, they drag the senators over to the Republican committee, the Democratic committee. So it really is more like an extortion, a situation where the people in business feel like, boy, I better give this money. Otherwise, maybe my business is going to get hurt. So it really is a racket. And we made it a federal crime in terms of soft money. It should also be a federal crime in terms of these independent contributions that aren't really independent at all.
You know, we're talking specifically about the sort of the corruption of the electoral process, and that's where the extortion happens. But no one's forcing these corporations to spend so much money on lobbying. Nobody's forcing them to hire former chief of staffs or staffers from someone's office. What can we done? I mean, assuming that we are, at least for the time being, until the Supreme Court revisits this, we are where we're at in terms of electoral campaign finance corrupting the electoral process. But what about the legislative process? Are there things that we can do on the side of dealing with staffers, of dealing with a revolving door, of dealing with the corruption that takes place in our regulatory bodies by some other means?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, of course, actually with the current president, we passed the laws that strengthen the lobbying laws, but they need to even be stronger. I mean, there is this unwritten code in Washington that top legislators or their top staffs can go down and work on K Street for a huge amount of money, even if they don't know much about anything, they just know some people. And so that period, cooling off period, the revolving door period, could be lengthened. But my feeling on this, Sam, is that what happens with the unlimited undisclosed contributions is that both parties play this game and they raise this kind of money and they're essentially already bought off by the time they get sworn in. And so, yeah, sure, they're going to lobby. Sure, they're going to use these techniques. But you won't even have people that are independent to try to have these rules relate to if you don't have change in the Citizens United. But, yes, there's a whole kinds of things I think you can do to try to limit this. I do believe people have a right to lobby under the First Amendment. But that doesn't mean there can't be full disclosure and limitations on the unholy connection between those in office and when they leave office.
The FCC on Friday voted to require broadcasters to disclose just how much money they're getting from these political campaigns. And when we see hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars being raised, much of that money ends up on broadcast radio or television in the form of advertising. Is there any way in which we can curb it from that end? In other words, we have restrictions. We license these entities. Is there any way that we can simply say there's only so much advertising you can present?
Well, I'm really pleased that the FCC did that. It's just long overdue. And this is the part of the story that is not being told. We know that politicians are involved in this unlimited spending. We know that we hear about the people that give the money. But where's the money going? And finally, there's some conversation about the huge benefit that goes to these broadcasters of this corrupt system. So this is the first step. I think other steps can be taken as well. The original McCain-Feingold bill required that broadcasters give 50% off on television time if somebody agreed to public financing. So as part of a public financing system, we could at least create a mechanism where through the government, these people have to give lower rates. There are other regulations about what can be charged and what can't be charged, and there is more opportunity for that as well.
And tell me just sort of in a broader perspective, Citizens United is perhaps, and maybe the Affordable Care Act, are seem to be the first two cases, maybe since Bush v. Gore, that the left has paid any attention to or any serious attention to the Supreme Court and the relevance of our courts in our system. Where would you place this court relative to past courts, and do you see an awakening on the left on the relevance of the court?
Well, it's just beginning. I mean, in fairness to some of the decisions after 9/11, the Supreme Court did do the right thing on some civil liberties decisions by not letting extreme executive power go forward, and Kennedy and others were good on that. So in that area, the court has been, before these last two justices came on anyway, somewhat of a pushback on extreme executive power. But you're right. With regard to legislation, major legislation, such as Tillman Act, actually, and with regard to the health care bill, the court is starting to act like a partisan legislature. And I think that's very damaging, and progressives need to take a look at this. You know, progressives, of course, have been grateful for the fact that the court has stood up for individual rights and over the years and some of the other decisions that have been made, such as Brown v. Board. But we have to remember that if it becomes a partisan body where people just vote according to what president's party that appointed them, it destroys the credibility of the court. And I think everyone in the country, not just the left, but including the left, is awakening the fact that in a lot of ways this court doesn't seem to be on the level, which is not only dangerous for the court, it's dangerous for our democracy, because we need a legitimate court that is perceived as being on the level, and I think they are really on the precipice of serious trouble if they knock down this health care law.
Has President Obama done enough, do you think, to fill the lower courts? I mean, I know there's been a tremendous amount of obstruction by the Republicans, and I know that's got to be particularly offensive to your sensibilities, because I think in many respects you held the right of a president to nominate and appoint justices as sacrosanct in many respects when you were
this has to be taken up quite a few notches. I've heard in the last 2 weeks a lot of people really concerned about this, and of course he's being obstructed, but it's got to be a higher priority because he cannot miss the opportunity to undo the extreme approach of Republican presidents for decades of trying to fill the courts with very young, very conservative Federalist Society people. That's how you end up with a partisan court. So it's extremely important that the president intensify his efforts on this and cash in some chits to get these judges through.
And I've heard you say that, you know, and I know that you're a campaign co-chair of President Obama's. And I've heard you say that, you know, at the very least, the Supreme Court is a huge reason to vote for President Obama. But give me your sense of how he's been impacted by, you know, he's had to start his own super PAC. How do you think that his administration and just over since Citizens United has passed has been affected by this need to go out and raise hundreds of millions of dollars from these corporations?
Well, I don't believe he had to do this. And even though I'm a campaign co-chair, I think he should have done just the opposite, which is to not go down this road. I think it's damaging for his reputation and damaging for the Democratic Party. But surely the advent of these huge contributions had an impact in 2010 on helping the Tea Party get its way in the election and do such damage to create not only a Republican House, you know, that's one thing, but a Republican House whose mission was to make sure he got absolutely nothing done. And now it's affecting the presidential race. The possibility of unlimited money coming his way has scared the White House into going down this road that I think actually tarnishes the president's image. And so it is having a negative impact there, and I hope that he moves away from it as much as possible.
Sarah Feingold, thanks so much for taking the time. I know you're very busy today, and I appreciate your taking the time.
I look forward to getting on the show again.
All right. Well, that can be arranged. I appreciate it.
We will do it.
Okay. All right, folks, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Alexis Goldstein of Occupy SEC and Occupy in general on yesterday's massive, massive demonstration of force. Force, perhaps? Massive demonstration of people power in New York City yesterday. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Alexis Goldstein of Occupy the SEC. Welcome to the program, Alexis.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. I want to talk to you about yesterday, your experiences out there. But let's back up a little bit and let's just talk a little bit about Occupy SEC and how you came to become a part of it. What is the Occupy SEC?
So we're a working group within Occupy Wall Street, and we're basically, for the last few months, we've been focused on one thing, which was writing a comment letter about a rule called the Volcker Rule, which essentially aims to prevent government banks that have government support and have received TARP money and secret Fed lending from proprietary trading, which I always try to explain as gambling. So the idea is if you have customer deposits and you've received bailouts and it's likely that the government will bail you out in the future, you don't get to play casino. You don't get to behave like a hedge fund.
And this is basically sort of a firewall between sort of commercial banking and investment speculative banking.
It is. It's not a true sort of Glass-Steagall-like firewall. There's certainly a lot that is allowed by the Volcker Rule, like things like underwriting, which is helping companies go public, or market making, which is kind of acting as an intermediary. But it does take the riskiest part of investment banking, which is this proprietary trading or speculative trading, and prevent it from happening at what's called a bank holding company.
So it's like a more like a picket fence.
Yeah.
But it's better than nothing, I guess. But let me ask you about that question. I mean, and I should also say, when you say you sent a comment letter, it was 230 pages.
Right? Yeah, it was 325.
We should be clear that this was not your typical letter. This was practically a book. And so, but do you think? I mean, one of the criticisms that I read at the time, and you folks submitted this, I guess, a month and a half ago, maybe more, 2 months at this point.
Yeah, it was in February, mid-February.
So one of the criticisms I heard was that, you know, by validating the picket fence, if you will, it forecloses the argument that there should be a firewall. In other words, the Volcker Rule is because you have the ability to sort of there are holes in it that what we really need is a Glass-Steagall. Give me your sense as to why it was still important to have a say on that Volcker Rule.
Well, I don't think that the two are mutually exclusive, and I think we would try to take a really pragmatic approach. As of right now, there is no one. I think there is a bill that sort of asks for a Glass-Steagall-like rule, but it's not really getting any traction, and I think we might see another one sort of in the future, but there wasn't anything serious that had passed. And the Volcker Rule passed, and it is law. And so the Administrative Procedure Act is this law from I think the 30s, that sort of gives the public the right to weigh in on any new piece of regulation. And so because the Volcker Rule did successfully pass and was a part of Dodd-Frank, our sense was, why should we be purists and sort of criticize this for not going far enough when this is on the table? And we wanted to sort of make it as strong as it could be and write a comment supporting the strongest Volcker Rule we could ask for, rather than sort of criticize what it doesn't do.
And when does that process end? In other words, when do we have the Volcker Rule that we're ultimately going to be living with, at least for the time being?
So they're supposed to have this done by July 21st of this year. Bernanke and Mary Shapiro, Ben Bernanke of the Fed and Mary Shapiro of the SEC have come out and said that they're not sure they're going to do it on time. But 22 senators recently, headed by Merkley and Levin, wrote a letter urging the regulators to finish it sometime in the summer. And then there was also a House letter that called for the same thing. So we're not really sure if it's going to be finalized by the summer or not. That's certainly the idea and the hope. But there is a two-year conformance period. So whenever the rule is finalized, the banks essentially have until 2014 to get their house in order and make sure that they're fully compliant with the Volcker Rule.
And once you submit that, I mean, do you have any sense of how much attention is being paid to the work that you guys did? Because, I mean, I've heard people
right.
characterize it as probably the most comprehensive comment letter and one of the smartest.
Well, we met with all of the agencies on the joint rulemaking. So that's the SEC, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, and the OCC. And they, had some interesting questions for us. They're very sort of limited in what they can say. They can't say whether they agree or disagree with any of the positions that we took, but they can ask us questions. And they were very respectful and very receptive, and there were a large number of people in all of the meetings. But we won't know until the final rule what their sort of opinion is. But in the final rule, they have to sort of cite a lot of the comments that they received. Mm. And there's no guarantee that they will cite parts of our letter, but I think it would be a very strong signal if they don't, given how many different areas we sort of questioned and pushed back on. So we won't really know what the official position is, but from what we've seen so far, they're certainly taking it into consideration.
Right. No, none of these regulators gave you like a secret thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah, they're really like tight-lipped. I mean, they're not politicians, but in some ways, I guess they have to act like them. And
all right. Well, so how did you end up part of the Occupy movement? How did you end up with the Occupy, the SEC?
So I showed up at Liberty Square about 2 weeks in. I kind of looked at it a little skeptically at first, like I think a lot of people did. But then I showed up after that first big Union Square march with the pepper spray incident. And I said that this is, unacceptable, and I wanted to show my solidarity. And then I just kind of fell in love with the movement, and I was hooked. And I was going down every day and having these amazing conversations. And Naomi Klein came down and gave an open forum talk. And I asked her a question. I said, should we bring back Glass-Steagall? And she said, basically, yes. And maybe three or four came up to me and said, well, what is Glass-Steagall? And so I thought, well, I can be useful in there. And so I did a teach-in, a lot of things, including that. That's where I talked about Tori, who is the founding member of the group. He's a lawyer, and he'd written.
I'm sorry, Alexis, we're having problems again. We're going to have to try this one more time. Okay, Alexis, sorry about that. You heard Naomi Klein speak. They had asked a question about a question about Glass-Steagall, and you realized that you could be a part. And why was that? What was your background that you could answer the question about Glass-Steagall?
Well, so I spent 7 years working on Wall Street, and the first firm I worked at was Morgan Stanley, which was sort of born out of Glass-Steagall. And so they kind of always gave us a very storied history of how Morgan Stanley was born out of this law. And so
born out of the repeal of Glass-Steagall or born out of the law itself?
Well, no. So Morgan, J.P. Morgan used to have an investment bank, and then Glass-Steagall came around, and they forced J.P. Morgan to decide, do you want to be a commercial bank or do you want to be an investment bank? And they decided to be a commercial bank, and so a few members of J.P. Morgan spun off Morgan Stanley as a standalone investment bank. So it was actually born out of Glass-Steagall.
And of course, that meant that the depositors' money was not being used at the casino, essentially.
Right, two totally separate companies.
Okay, so you've talked about how you fell in love with the movement. Give me your reaction to yesterday. You were out there, I know, from the early morning till 9 or 10 at night. Tell me your sense of what took place, because a lot of people were basically saying this is important for Occupy Wall Street to show that the enthusiasm is still there. Do you think that happened?
It was incredible, and I'm a little disappointed at the mainstream media, although no surprise there at the sort of lack of coverage, because we had tens of thousands of people in the street at Union Square and then the Union Square March downtown. But even from the beginning of the day, even though it was raining, we still had a pretty strong showing, you know, probably 1,000 people right there at 8 in the morning. And then we all sort of separated and went on probably 20 pickets total, all sort of many of them simultaneously happening. And then people marched from Bryant Park down to Union Square and then from Union Square downtown. So it was sort of like this full day of celebration and protest, and it was beautiful, and I really blew my expectations away. I wasn't really sure what to expect, but I didn't expect it was going to be as big as it was.
All right, so just give us a rundown of what your day was like. Matt, my producer, and I were at Bryant Park from about 12 to 1:30, and when we got there, I'd say there was probably 500 people or so, and we had just seen a march that was leaving Bryant Park, and so about 1,000 people there at the beginning would make sense. By the time we left, that number was probably closer to 2,000 at Bryant Park, and the Guitarmy was just about to leave. So what did you do prior to that time, and what happened afterwards?
So around 8 a.m., there was a big mic check, and you basically got to choose which picket you wanted to go to. They went to HSBC. They went to Chase. I chose to go to Bank of America. But then all throughout the day, the pickets kept moving around because there was a huge number of different companies that were the target of pickets. So I went from the Bank of America picket in the morning over to the J.P. Morgan Chase one. Then we sort of doubled back to John Paulson, who owns the hedge fund, and I guess his claim to fame is he custom selected some CDOs to put in a portfolio that Goldman then found a sucker to sell it to. And Goldman wasn't supposed to let him choose the securities he was going to bet against. That was supposed to be an independent third party. So we protested outside of John Paulson.
So wait a second. We should really, because that's one of my favorite stories. This guy basically sells, puts together a bunch of lemons, tells Goldman mm-hmm. Sachs to sell it, and then goes and shorts the lemons, bets against the lemons, because he knows they're lemons.
Right. And the SEC settled with Goldman Sachs for, I think, a little over $500 million. But Goldman did not have to sort of admit any wrongdoing. And as far as I know, Paulson hasn't had to pay a penny. But I know he made a good $15 billion or so, not just on that one trade, but in the course of the crisis.
That's just a tremendous amount. I just love that story. It's like going out and starting a car dealership with cars. None of them have mufflers, and then opening a muffler shop right next door.
Yep. We had a good chant for him. It was Paulson profits off our pain. He and Goldman rigged the game.
And so then you head back to Bryant Park. And as the march, as people start to leave Bryant Park, it seemed to me that people were going to both Madison Square Park, where there was a teach-in going on, and then down
right.
to Union Square.
There was so much happening simultaneously. I think the Madison Square Park teach-ins were from about 10 to 2:30, and there were even a few other pickets other than that. There was one outside of Chipotle because there's a group called the Immokalee Workers Fair Food Alliance, and they are the tomato pickers in Immokalee, Florida, and they produce a huge amount of the tomatoes in the United States. And they have a fair food program they've asked their sort of, I guess, the vendors and the people that buy their tomatoes to sign on to. And Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, and McDonald's have all signed on, but Chipotle has not.
Wow.
So that was going on, the Madison Square Park teach-ins with some CUNY professors. And then, yeah, we left. When did we leave? Around 2, a little after 2. And, yeah, Tom Morello, as you said, was leading the Guitarmy, the army of guitarists, down. And that was a really fun march. And we had a lot of sort of tourists sort of looking and waving and smiling along the way.
And so give me your sense of I want to just step back from the actions yesterday, because I think nothing could show that the enthusiasm around Occupy is still alive. And frankly, I think, you know, based upon the numbers growing, the criticism I'm starting to hear now from people who supposedly were more enthused in the fall, and I'm talking about, I'm talking more the liberal establishment, is that Occupy has to have a more specific message. What is your response to that?
Well, what I always try to tell people is maybe we don't have one specific demand, but we have a very clear theme. And that theme is that the corporations have taken over and Congress is sort of corrupt beyond repair, because not just because of campaign contributions, but because of the inordinate amount of lobbying. And, you know, there's been some statistics put out, and you had Chris Hayes on the program, I guess it was last week or the week before, and he was talking about how there are statistics that show the sort of bottom third of income have no say. Absolutely zero say over the political process. And so this is really about that. It's about that money has captured our system. Corporations have captured our system. And the only way we can have a voice is to take the streets. And so I really do think that that is the one overarching theme that unites so many of these disparate cries and demands that you hear throughout the movement.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. Alexis Goldstein, Occupy the SEC, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks so much, Sam. Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. Got a lot of nice feedback on the show yesterday. And many of you don't end up listening to the show until later anyways. So, but I want to thank you for that. That was nice. We had fun out there. And Matt, you were out. Dude, you're living life like a single guy who's got, who doesn't have to go home and buy the groceries, then go do Young Turks, then come back and eat dinner and help put Milo to bed because you won't go to sleep these days.
Well, actually, my girlfriend met me, and we went together.
Oh.
So I guess not like a single guy, but as a guy without kids.
There you go.
Because I am a guy without kids.
Well, that so, all right, what did you see? Give me your sense, because, you know, the crowds, there was an amazing. Do you have this audio of this Reuters thing? No.
No, I don't.
Okay. There was an amazing story where at about, I guess it was about, what, 4:30, right? Reuters puts out a video piece, and we'll link to it at Majority FM. Reuters puts out an amazing video piece saying, Occupy Wall Street resurgence, a dud. Now, this is what I was talking about early in the program. There was a legitimate news story here. And that is, this movement, which captured the imagination of the country last fall, was essentially suppressed as city after city, in coordination with the feds, got the occupiers out of their encampments. And the question was, for months, at least weeks, we know that Occupy has been planning these May Day protests, marches, celebrations, however you want to call it. And the real question was, has Occupy matured from an organizational standpoint? And has the enthusiasm for Occupy, has it waned or has it grown? Has it stayed the same? What was happening? This is a very legitimate news question. And frankly, that's why I was so surprised I didn't see virtually any coverage of it on MSNBC. We saw it on Fox, and we know that they tried to say, well, it was just full of hooded vandals. And it's true in Seattle, where there has been a long history of black bloc tactics, far predating the existence of Occupy Wall Street. People took the opportunity of May Day to go out and smash some windows, which in my estimation, not terribly helpful, not very effective. We know in San Francisco there was some tension. There was protest there. Chicago, protests. Around the world, protests. So Reuters takes that question, perfectly legitimate question, is Occupy back? Puts out a piece at about 4:30 in the afternoon, emanating from New York now, saying Occupy a dud. And the video, you can tell, I mean, we were there in Bryant Park. The video was clearly from earlier in the day. Remember, it was raining till about 11:30 in New York City.
And on top of that, earlier in the day, there was about 50 different events going on all throughout the five boroughs, not just Manhattan.
We just heard Alexis Goldstein tell us about the 20, 25 different protests that were happening. I know that when we hit the park, we saw a parade of 300 or 400 people leaving the park, and then it came back in about an hour and a half later, And meanwhile, we were also aware of actions happening on Park Avenue. We were aware of Wildcat marches that were happening downtown in Soho and Chinatown. And this was just the beginning. So Reuters, I guess, really wanted to file first. And, well, they came out with this video that said it was done. Let's play just a couple of seconds of it.
Occupy Wall Street was planning to make a big comeback, taking aim at old targets like Bank of America and headquarters of Rupert Murdoch's News Corp empire. But the demonstration lacked the crowds of the protests' early days, leading many to question if the movement has any movement left. Political strategist Henry Scheinkopf says the group's day in the spotlight is fading fast because it lacks one clear message everyday Americans can rally behind.
The Vietnam War movement, the anti-war movement, excited people. People paid tremendous prices, went to jail, did all kinds of things. People were murdered to fight for civil rights. The farm workers movement, well, and even solidarity in Poland. People died in the course of creating a social and political movement that created an outcome. What's the outcome here? It's not clear. And when you're muddled, you'll lose.
All right, first of all, this guy who seems to know so much about these movements must know that none of the movements he was talking about, had he judged them 6 months in, would have achieved what he was talking about.
Well, interestingly enough, Jeff Smith, our very own Jeff Smith, did some research on this political strategist, Scheinkopf, and he's a former lobbyist for Bear Stearns.
Surprise, surprise.
Wow. So Reuters talks about the actions that happen at 8 a.m. in the rain, says that they weren't that well attended, just a couple hundred people, then goes to a former lobbyist for investment bankers and finds out that this is a problem with this movement. It's not going anywhere. Releases this video at 3 in the afternoon. Apparently, now, remember, this guy shoots the video. Then he goes back to his office, sits there with an editor and cuts. I think he left Bryant Park because that was the last footage I saw. I think he left Bryant Park somewhere around the time, just a little bit before we did, based upon the pictures that I saw. So he's leaving at about 12:30, comes out with this report at about 4. It's tweeted out. People are like, a dud. Meanwhile, people who are reading this tweet are sitting amongst literally 10,000 people in Union Square and growing.
I was in Union Square when I saw that tweet come out, and that tweet spread throughout the people there, and people were just like, where is this person? What event are they at?
And at about 4 o'clock when this thing came out was just when the throngs of people are heading to Union Square. They start to march down. It took something like 40 minutes. Like, people at the front of the march had been marching for 40 minutes, and there were still thousands of people in Union Square waiting to get into the march. They shut down Broadway from 14th Street, I think south of Houston. And so you're talking about 10, 20, 30,000 people, I think easily. And you were at that big, that biggest union protest. How would you place it?
I've never seen Union Square that packed before in my life. I mean, you literally could not move. Like, it wasn't like you were at, like, a protest event or even, like, you know, an all-day festival where, like, you just see a lot of people and you're moving throughout a crowd. Like, you could not move throughout that crowd. It was packed shoulder to shoulder. 15,000 people. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean,
So can we safely say, Reuters, your report, a dud.
The funny thing is, about an hour later, they put out a second tweet with a linking to a story that said, "Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street's resurgence, far from a dud."
Wow, that's a big correction. Far from a dud. How about saying a massive success? That's another way of saying that.
Well, to me, that's clear that they were trying to save face. I mean, they were like, right. Oh, we left out some words. We meant to say this originally.
Right. All right, folks. That is the end of the first half of our show. It's halftime.
It's halftime on the Majority Report.
And we'll be back with the better half of the show, Obama on Marijuana. Yes. The do-nothing Congress. This Congress is beyond do-nothing. Romney fires his gay, or I should say, his foreign policy advisor resigned because he was too gay for Republicans. Also, Rupert Murdoch, just, man, the guy's name is Mud now. This is the British government saying this. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, 646-257-3920. Want to hear your responses to Senator Feingold's interview. I don't do, I try to do no politicians on this show. I've had some. Senator Harkin, I guess. A couple of congresspeople. And I rarely have former politicians on, Grayson. Senator Feingold, head of Progressives United, great organization, and he was one of my favorite senators. So I want to get your response to that. Use 646-257-3920, or you can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, you know, it doesn't matter when I ask for people to become members because doesn't seem to be working. So, but become a member. We've had a lot of people. April was just a very difficult month economically for people, I think, because we lost a decent amount of members. So if you can afford to become a member, please do. And many other ways to support the show, justcoffee.coop, 10% coupon code majority. Buy your crap through our Amazon link at support the show. Buy merch. Give us a good review on iTunes. Meet us in the better half right now.